You're listening to Around Comics, Watching Before Watchmen, The Comedian, number 2. Welcome back to another episode of Around Comics. This is Sal.
This is Brackstone.
And this is Watching Before Watchmen, The Comedian, issue number 2. If you're not familiar with what Watching Before Watchmen is, this is basically where we sit down with every single individual issue of the Before Watchmen event from DC Comics, and we go over every issue in excruciating detail, and we try and determine if it's any damn good. We have been doing this for a while now, like a couple of months. We are all the way through all the number one issues already. So if you haven't listened before, go ahead back and listen to any of those. And we are now on to the number twos for some of the series.
We've moved on.
We have moved on to the twos. We're on number twos. And this one is The Comedian, number 2, by Brian Azzarello and J.G. Jones, with colors by Alex Sinclair and letters by Clem Robbins. Yeah, so there you go. Basically, we left off with Eddie Blake, the comedian, in the first issue. It left off. Oh, wait, before we go too much further, I do want to warn you, there will be spoilers involved. We're going to talk in depth about the issue. So we will be talking about, plot events and everything that happens in it. So if you haven't read it and you don't want to be spoiled, stop listening.
I don't think there's anything too.
No, there's not a whole lot really to spoil.
Nothing you could ruin too bad. Spoiler alert.
Just want to give that out there. All right. So basically we left off the first issue with Eddie, being.
It was November 1963.
Yes, and Eddie was being tricked into leaving his guard down and allowing the assassination of his friend, the President of the United States, John F. Kennedy. Eddie was sort of tricked into going on a little bullshit mission.
Possibly.
Yeah, we don't know, but that was the feeling I got, that they kind of took him out of... took him out of pocket, I guess.
Yeah, took him away from the president, which he was going. And we're led to believe that it could be the FBI, but we don't know who duped him.
Yeah, we're not sure exactly, but somebody didn't want him around Dallas in 1963. But we start this issue in 1964, February to be exact, at a very famous fight, the first Muhammad Ali, or Cassius Clay as he was known at that time.
Cassius Clay. He was still searching for a name, I think, at this time. He wasn't sure where he was going to go with.
The boxer, Cassius Clay, fighting then very scary and intimidating heavyweight champion of the world, Sonny Liston. And Eddie is in attendance with Robert Kennedy. Which I found kind of interesting that, you know, only like three months.
This is about three and a half months. They're moving on.
I guess Robert's got to see a fight, you know. But they're sitting there kind of talking away, and I really enjoyed this opening sequence as the fight was happening and Ali was winning the heavyweight championship of the world at a very young 22, I believe he was.
Mm-hmm.
We see Eddie and Robert Kennedy talking about a couple of different things. One being Robert sort of fed up with dealing with the corruption in politics and with different things that he's trying to fight to no avail, whether it's Jimmy Hoffa and the unions or, you know, just sort of the American.
Yeah, he's the attorney. He's the attorney general. So he's
the top cop.
Yeah, at this point, he was going after Hoffa, I think. And he just made the comment, you know, to Eddie. He said, "I'm right about Hoffa, Eddie. The sheriffs are criminals." And Eddie replied, the criminals are sheriffs, Bobby. You know, so I don't know what aspect of Bobby Kennedy's pursuit of Jimmy Hoffa that was referring to. I don't, you know, I'm sure we could do all kind of research to find out, you know, how I think he went after him for bribery and jury tampering, but
yeah, he went after him for a lot of different things.
The point I think that Azzarello was making with all that is just showing a bit of history and maybe time and place in the story. I don't know, but it's
I think he's also showing that, you know, Bobby's sort of in a tough situation for someone like him. I mean, from all accounts, he was a very, you know, honest elected official and was, you know, very much trying to do his best to fight crime. And he was surrounded by corrupt individuals that wanted to stop him from doing that at every turn. So I think, you know, part of it was just sort of showing, you know, why he, you know, was tired of doing that. And also sort of saying, hey, I'm going to stop doing this and I'm going to run for Senate and eventually hopefully lead to the presidency.
The White House.
I mean, which we know, you know, didn't unfortunately happen. But, and then at the same time, Eddie mentions that Robert McNamara, who is the
Secretary
of Defense at the time, has asked him to go to Vietnam as a advisor.
And McNamara, I watched this documentary on him with my father-in-law, and he's heralded as being the architect of Nam, basically, according to that documentary I watched. So it makes sense that he would send the comedian, Lee Blake, to
the architect of Vietnam as far as, like, setting it up, or
there was a lot, I guess, of decisions maybe that he spurred and initiated once we were in there or something. I'll have to look at it again. It was real interesting, but you know, he lived to his 90s. He recently passed, and but a lot of people didn't really like him, and they laid a lot of Vietnam at his feet, but. Again, we're in this whole section during the fight of name throwing of you know, historical name throwing. I think Hoover's mentioned, Hoffa, McNamara sending Eddie Blake to Nam.
And at this point, he's still Secretary of Defense under Johnson.
Yeah.
At this point, so. Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, McNamara, you know, he was responsible, or he was the Secretary of State, or Defense, I should say, at the time of the biggest escalation of American troops in Vietnam. So, and he was behind it. I mean, he was in agreement. He felt that, you know, there was a domino effect at play if Vietnam fell to communism, that Cambodia and Laos and the surrounding areas would as well, and that was a threat to America. And, you know, he sort of tried to sell that, you know, or was sold that kind of company line along with, you know, a lot of people at that time. But certainly he was a big part of it. And I don't know my Vietnam history or Robert McNamara.
I don't either. That's a horrible, thick conflict of all kinds of stuff. But I think we can walk away with Eddie Blake tells Bobby Kennedy that McNamara is sending him to Vietnam as an advisor, and he thinks that he's going to battle communism.
Right.
Eddie Blake is. And, you know, he's he's all about it. You know, he's, sure. he's all about fighting communism. That's his belief. And I think,
and he also understands what he's about. You know, I mean, he kind of says, "Hey, I'm good at this. This is what I can do. So, you know, I'm kind of sitting over here."
He tells Bobby Kennedy, "There's nobody but me in my line of work."
Yeah. And during this whole thing, the fight's going on, and Ali wins the fight. And I thought it was interesting that Eddie is sort of rooting for Sonny Liston because that seems to fit his character very much.
Yeah, he's got paper on Sonny Liston.
Yeah,
for sure.
He seems to make really bad bets. Historically it seems, but we get a lot of information in these first couple of pages. In a lot of information in the sense of, you know, Bobby's feelings about Vietnam and about, you know, different things that are going on in his life and in the world, and also Eddie's feelings about things. And I thought one of the more interesting things at the end of this, sort of at the end of the fight and the conversation, Eddie's like, "Can you believe this?" And Ali's going on and on about, you know, how he shook up the world. He's a bad man. He can't be beat. You know, very famous post-fight stuff. And Bobby turns to him and says, "Eddie, you of all people should recognize when the fix is in," which is interesting that, you know, the suggestion that fight was fixed.
Because it was always rumored that Sonny Liston took a fall.
Well, see, here's the thing. Like, this was the first fight between them. I wasn't really aware that that there was speculation that Sonny Liston had thrown that fight. Now, the second one was the Phantom Punch fight.
It wasn't. I don't know my fights that I didn't know. So this one isn't the one that had all the rumors where.
Not that I remember it to be. I would have thought it was.
Yeah, especially since they made that statement. But
yeah, the second one was the one with the Phantom Punch, and everyone believed that, you know, Sonny was paid off by the mob to throw the fight, that kind of thing. Now the first one too, people may have. I just don't recollect that.
Bring it to the forum, people.
Yeah, I don't know.
Bring it.
I'm sure there are people that may know that better than I do. But I thought it was more the second one. But you know, he was a 22-year-old brash. Relatively not unknown, but I mean, he was not expected to beat Liston.
Cassius Clay.
Yeah, at that time, he was not expected to beat the veteran, the champion, the very much feared Sonny Liston.
He shook the world, man.
He did. He did shake up the world. But
a bad man.
But I just thought that was interesting, and I've had not to name drop, but I've had conversations about boxing and Ali with Brian Azzarello, so. I know
he's a fan. He's all.
He's a sports fan. He's a boxing fan. Absolutely. I don't know that he's an Ali fan though. So I don't know. Maybe that was just Brian sort of taking a shot at Ali.
I want to say this about this scene before we move to the next. Expertly written. I felt like Azzarello took. He did some research. You know, he took time and what was going on in history and. Where we were with Vietnam and, you know, the dates that Kennedy was assassinated, the dates of the fight, where, I mean, he definitely put his story, you know, weaved it through American history like this. And I thought it was really well done.
Well, and I also think the idea, and I don't know, this could just be me looking into it a little too much, but the idea of that fight in particular was very much a young, brash Ali or Cassius Clay at that time going up against what was considered very much a bully. Sonny Liston was very much of a bully, and Ali was the underdog in that fight, and he stood up to that bully. And so it was sort of interesting in that respect with, you know, Robert Kennedy and his sort of underdog persona to some degree, whether it's living in the shadow of his brother or, you know, go fighting against the system as he always seemed to be doing. So I don't know. I just thought it was an interesting choice of you know that event to pick for this conversation.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
You're too meta.
Maybe.
I think it's just.
Well, okay. Let me throw you this one though. In the first panel, who are those two guys walking up to the Miami Convention Center? They look like anybody?
Well, one guy looks like Dean for sure.
And the other guy with the hat, I mean that, and the trench coat.
Are you trying to say that looks like Frank Sinatra?
I think that's Frank and Dean. I mean,
I know that's Dean, man.
Yeah, that's Dean for sure. All he needs is a drink in his hand.
Frank has got a little bit too much chin.
He's a little paunch, little heavy at that time. I'm trying to remember. I don't think at that point Frank was heavy.
J.G. Jones could have been searching for reference.
Yeah, but that's definitely Dean, right? I mean, that's
Dean. Yeah. I mean, you're right. I picked him right up. So,
yeah. All right. Well, we move on. We're deep into this, and we're only four
Makes
pages.
Me a whiskey or something. Seeing that picture, Dean.
As we move on, Eddie has now traveled to Vietnam, and he is
airport.
What?
He just got to the airport in Vietnam. He's met by Colonel Pitch, who basically starts in this rhetoric. We're going to see a whole lot in this issue of course, everyone in Nam is bemoaning the conflict and letting anyone who just got to Nam onto the real truth on this shit, you know?
Well, and I think, you know, the thing we should make clear is that, you know, their complaints are basically, you know, what a lot of military people have said in hindsight of, you know, they weren't given the tools to really fight this war. They were there in sort of a weird position. And at this point in Vietnam, they were supposed to be defensive. It was a defensive position, which for the U.S. Army and the Marines and the, you know, the U.S. military at that time, it was exactly what they didn't do. You know what I mean? They were not trained to be defensive minded. They were trained to be offensive minded for decades. So now you send all these guys over there and you tell them to sort of hold down the fort and not to make noise and not to, you know, start conflict. And we see that frustration come out real quickly as, you know, Colonel Pitch and the rest of the guys that he's sort of united up with, you know, start talking about how they're feeling very frustrated with it, that they don't feel like they've been given the tools to do the job or even really explain how to do the job. What they're supposed to do there.
And they looked to Comedian's arrival. They're real optimistic, and I guess he has this reputation. So everyone is definitely for the Comedian coming to Nam,
which I felt was a little odd. I mean, I guess, you know, he had so much press by that point, and he had been around for a long time at that point that people would be very much impressed with him, but like. You know, he's going around, like, shaking down, you know, bartenders and dock workers and beating up, you know, like, sailors and stuff. Like, how does that translate into this?
Well, that was when he was – that. You know, I thought a lot about that. That's when he was 16, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And at this point, he's, like, what, 35 or something?
You think he's 35? I think he might be 40.
40? I mean, he's definitely, he's up there. So he's been around for a while. So we don't know exactly what happened in between 16 and 40 that made him, you know, nationally.
Yeah, and he's definitely adopted, as we've seen his relationship with the Kennedys, for the Kennedys to embrace him.
Right.
He's moved up into this legitimate national hero type.
Right.
Persona, and you know his costume has of course changed. Oh, here's a freaking problem I got throughout the whole issue is where's the smiley face? He never has a smiley face on.
Well, I don't think he adopted that until later.
Yeah, but I always thought that's part of. I mean, he's a comedian, so the only thing that brings his whole ensemble to his namesake is that smiley face. It's almost the cherry.
Well, at this point, he's very much this patriotic-looking symbol. I mean, he has stars and stripes
true.
And that.
Again, he is a comedian, and he almost has to have that thing. But I don't know. Maybe he picks that up later. But I just thought that that was something he always had. Because, you know, in, when he was 16, if you look at his belt buckle, he has that comedy almost.
Well, he's more of a jester. He's dressed more of like a jester or something at that point. And then he transforms into this more of a mercenary kind of looking guy. And a little tougher of a look to him. I'm trying to remember in Watchmen when he, I thought it was like in Vietnam when he adopted that, but anyway, we'll see. But anyway, I mean, right away, like his first night there, we see,
he's going to shake it up.
He's going to shake things up. Cause there's shooting from the, SVN,
that's the
South Vietnam, Southern, Vietnamese, or no, not the SVN, my
SVN
history.
is the Southern,
they're in South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese attack.
They're just shooting at the base, basically.
Yeah, and the guys are all like, whatever, we're not going to do anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's run-of-the-mill course around here, Eddie Blake. Don't worry about it, sit down, have a, let's, what kind of cigar is that you're smoking? He's like, screw this, dude.
I'm taking care of business.
There's bullets being fired, and I'm not one of the people firing them. I'm going out here to fire some guns. So.
Right. And so he heads out, and some guys follow him into the bush, into the jungle.
Yeah, he's got some they really like him. They want to go where he's going, apparently.
Yeah, he's definitely got charisma to him, and he, you know, people, I think, you know, are definitely, you know, sort of follow him. He's a leader, you know, in some way.
But and that translates, and you know, the scene where they're kind of on patrol looking for the shooters at the base. There's more of the soldiers talking about that it's a conflict and you know, some of the problems and woes.
There's dissatisfaction with it, and they're starting to question why they're there. It's like, you know, these people don't want us here. What are we doing here? And Eddie's very black and white about it. It's like, hey, this is a war against communism. That's why we're here, period. There's no gray area for Eddie. It is what it is. This is a war. We're here to stop commies. Let's go do it. Quit, you know, just shut up and do your job is his sort of attitude about the whole thing. And then they get into a little fight with some North Vietnamese regular, and blow them to shit. And there's a literally Eddie throws a grenade and after they're, you know, they open up fire with the machine guns. Eddie throws a grenade and hits them, and we see this pretty disturbing scene where there's a younger Vietnamese soldier, and he was hit with a grenade, and he's missing his right arm, and he sort of staggers out of the smoke from it, and Eddie jumps on him and pulls a knife and just, you know, ends him right there, and, you know.
Yeah, that's where we see, like, there's two sides to Eddie, it seems like. There's that side, there's this, the side that we probably enjoyed punching the dock workers when he was 16, and that's the side that probably raped Sally Jupiter. That's this violent,
psychotic
side. Yeah. But he still believes that he is. I mean, there's this other side where he's winning over the presidents or the, you know, the Kennedys,
right?
Where he is a national hero. Where he,
he's a leader of men.
He's a leader. And where he's fighting communism, you know, where he thinks he's doing right. So he's a weird character, man.
He's complex. He's a different kind of, and I think he's very much a throwback at this point in 1964. You know, Eddie comes from an era, you know, in the 50s where, you know, things were just different.
Man.
Yeah, he's, we see sort of that, you know, I don't know if you watch, speaking of men's men, but you know, do you watch Mad Men at all?
No, I don't watch it.
It's a fantastic show. It's incredibly well done. I absolutely love it. But what it does is it really shows you sort of, you know, it's the beginning of that it's on its fourth or fifth season now, and in the beginning it starts off in the 50s, and it's New York, Manhattan, ad agencies, and it's all about, like, these guys that are very much, you know, making a ton of money and very much in power, and a lot of it is, a lot of time in the episode is spent showing, you know, sort of the other side of that, of you know, the how little rights women had, and how, and, you know, minorities, blacks in particular, how they were treated or mistreated, and you know, there's so much misogynistic attitudes, and just while these guys on the one side of it look very much like proper and patriotic and American and you know, good,
you solid, saw that, yeah, you saw
then
the...
you see the drinking and the womanizing and the, you know, all the other sides of it behind that, that, you know, that kind of led to that. So it's, I think we're, we kind of see that with Eddie too, of on the one hand, he is this sort of man's man and patriotic and in a weird way honorable, and you know, he has his code. You're just never quite sure, you know, like there's certain things that it's like, this is the way it is. And then there's things where it's like, well,
I got to get crazy.
Yeah. It's so you're never sure what side of the line it's on. At the end of this sequence with the fight with the Vietnamese soldiers, he says, what I believe, and it's at the end of a conversation with one of the other soldiers, how, you know, the other soldiers sort of like complaining about why they're there, and Eddie's like, you know, we're here to fight communism. And the soldier's like, what, you believe that? And he's like, at the end, after killing, stabbing this guy to death, he pulls out a flask, takes a drink, and says, what I believe is I'm going to like it here. And yeah, we see that sort of like, you know, craziness about Eddie that he, you know, that he does like the lawlessness and where a man like him can really, you know, kind of do whatever he wants. But
this is one protagonist that I honestly have no idea where what he's, what you could do with him, what he's going to do with him. I mean, is he going to try and vindicate him and make him us understand him in some scenario that he's going to do in future issues? I have no idea. Is he going to just leave us with, yeah, this is how shitty this guy is?
If you look at, you know, Azzarello's history, his body of
work. I've never read 100 Bullets. I do want to read that.
You should. You really need to read that. If you're going to call yourself a comic book fan, you should probably read that. You know, I think, you know, what Brian does really well a lot of times with characters is that he doesn't try and necessarily justify them or explain their actions all the time. I mean, sometimes people just do what they do. There isn't necessarily always an answer. There isn't always, you know, and most of his characters in most of the books that he does, it's not, they're not good guys. They're not good. I mean, 100 Bullets is all about criminals and killers and, you know, assassins and drug dealers. And it's all about the underworld. It's all about, you know, the seedy.
But you're following a couple of characters you sympathize with through it. I mean,
well, certainly, but I think you can do that with any character. You don't, I mean, you can make a, I mean, there's things about Eddie Blake that I like and I respect, and then there's things that I despise and I think are horrible. You know what I mean? Like, you can do that with characters, and I think that makes interesting characters when they're not just Superman. And it's like, you know, oh, everything is truth, justice, and the American way, and there's no gray, you know, that's all there is. You know, I think with Eddie's an interesting character. Now, ultimately, we know what kind of person he is. So it's not someone, he's not a hero. It's not someone, but that's Watchmen. I mean, those characters, they're all messed up. I mean, that's the thing with the original 12 issues and what Alan Moore did is there are no heroes in that book. those people are all severely screwed up. Mm. They just happen to put on costumes and go out and fight crime for different reasons. But they're not heroes. They're not heroic in the classical sense of it. They're not even anti-heroes. I mean, they're...
Well, I don't know. The Watchmen followed, and we're in some deep water away from the shore, which is this book. But real quick, Watchmen followed this whole narrative, and Alan Moore gave you Night Owl and Silk Spectre, and they were your beam of light or whatever. And that's my interpretation. You know, they were the... They guided you to the...
They were the least despicable of the characters. I mean, they were not bad. They weren't, you know, they weren't crazy like Rorschach or... Yeah.
But I don't think Watchmen would have been as good as it was had, you know, they had... they didn't find true love, or their love didn't come through at the end, and they found each other or something. If like one of them died, or if one of them turned out to have the same personality problems as, say, the comedian or whatever, that book would not leave you feeling as satisfied at the end, I don't think.
No, I agree, and the point is that they're not okay. Let's take Night Owl and Silk Spectre. You know, if you look at sort of the, and I think the whole, not the whole point, but one of the points of Watchmen was sort of reexamining heroic people or people that do heroic things or how we look at what heroes are. And you look at Night Owl. Okay, well, what, if you look at a classic sense of sort of the heroic figure, male figure, you know, virile and strong and, you know, in charge, and that's everything Night Owl isn't. He, you know, he's impotent and, you know, and weak-willed to some degree and, you know, that kind of thing. And then, you know, with Sally Jupiter, she's, you know, she's kind of beholden, and she's not a very strong female lead. She becomes stronger and that's the thing, like both of their stories change. You know what I mean? They grow. Yeah. But I mean, at the end of the, you know, it's like, you know, they're sort of these, you know.
Well, they're the least, you don't expect them to be this positive thing that they become. And I mean, yeah, Alan Moore was a genius when he chose the archetypes and played, turned archetypes on its head and everything. But he still left the reader feeling satisfied with the story by following the, okay, we got to have.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that. I don't read Watchmen and feel like, it's not like it's a feel-good ending. It's not like there's a joyous ending to it. It's ambiguous and sort of open-ended, and you don't know what the future holds. And it makes you think about it. I don't think, just because Sally and Night Owl, you know, just because they event, you know, they
so
find
would
each
you
other
say it's, they, would you say it's a completely bleak ending?
No, I don't think it's completely bleak, but I don't think it's that's my point. It's not one or the other. It's complex. It's the ending is as complex as the story. So I don't think you're going to see necessarily, I hope, at least I don't think, or I don't hope that you're going to see like one or the other. I don't think you're just going to see either a completely, you know, okay, Eddie's a piece of shit and we hate him,
yeah,
or Eddie's a heroic kind of guy. I think it's going to be complex. I think it will be,
I mean, it will be, but I don't know. And that was just a statement, you know, because at this point, I don't know. I mean, I could see Azzarello doing something with Eddie Blake to where he is forced to make a decision in the face of some great evil that he's witnessing or something that really accentuates his decisions in Watchmen later on that we all know he's going to do.
So you think maybe there's, you know, like there'll be some sort of redeeming?
I mean, that's just one story choice for him, but
maybe.
Who knows? But we need to We're all cool.
Yeah, we're all way, way far away from where we were. Okay, well, back to Vietnam and back to Eddie. After the little firefight, Eddie...
He's on a special mission or whatever.
Yeah, he's on a helicopter with the colonel, and they're sending him off on some sort of mission. We're not sure what it is, but he ends up finding this this little sort of villa somewhere in the mountains, and there's a... what looks to be a pudgy Italian mobster type guy, some soldiers and a Vietnamese general. Eddie comes busting in, shooting up the place and scaring the crap out of everybody.
And everybody's just dropping guns.
Yeah,
and
running. I mean, they're just
for Z Hills.
Yeah, they see the comedian and it's goodbye. We're not sticking around for this. And this guy, this gangster guy, is also just terrified. He can't believe that he's there, and he's now afraid that Eddie's going to shoot him.
Yeah, apparently this guy's a drug lord back in the States. And
I was trying to figure out who he was. There was a mention of him being put in trial and deported to Corsica. So,
you mean like Real World?
Yeah, Real World. And he calls him Sal, and I don't know if it's Sal Greco, who was a famous...
Brian Salazar.
Yeah, it's Brian Salazar. Me. No, there's a pretty notorious gangster called Sal Greco who was part of the French Connection, and he was on the run for a long time. And
full of pictures of him.
No, but I don't know if that was him or not. But he calls him Sal, and he talks about Corsica, and the significance of Corsica is the Corsican mafia was very much a the big part of sort of the French Connection of getting heroin out of Indochina and through France and into the rest of the world at this time in the 50s and from World War II to the 70s, really, they were influential in moving heroin out of Indochina and Vietnam and Cambodia specifically. So that's a just an important little part here. So as the sequence kind of winds down, you know, we're sitting there thinking, well, you know, he's going in to take care of this guy. And, you know, he finds this drug, you know, guy, this drug pusher, whatever he is, gangster guy, and he's going to take care of him. And then we find out at the end that it was a gag, that, it was a joke, and they're working with him.
Because the government essentially wants in on the action. They used the comedian as muscle, basically.
Right. And this all leads into the whole Air America thing. And if you haven't read or you don't know what Air America is or saw that terrible Robert Downey Jr. I think it was Robert Downey Jr. Was it Robert Downey? Or Mel Gibson?
It was Mel Gibson and some other dude with like a faux mullet thing.
It's a terrible movie about Air America. But what Air America was Air America was the CIA's private airline, and they used it for a lot of different things, moving people around, rescue missions, traveling gear all around Indochina, all around, especially in Vietnam during this time. They used it for many, many different things, but it was a private airline originally that was bought by the CIA, and it was sort of a secret that, you know, nobody knew that the CIA owned it and that they used it for all sorts of things. And one of the things that it has been talked about and rumored and never really proven, I don't think, but there's enough evidence now that it seems very much likely that they were moving heroin out of Vietnam on these CIA-owned planes. And what Azzarello asserts here in this is that they were doing that to fund the war. That these soldiers wanted to do more fighting and do more in Vietnam, but they needed the resources, and in order to do that, they...
Got it from drugs.
They made a deal with certain people and flew the drugs out, and they were able to then finance weapons and stuff for the South Vietnamese army that they could train and...
And that decision basically is still in keeping with comedians wanting to fight in Vietnam, to fight down against communism.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that
needs more money to do it. Hey, drugs. If we got to do drugs, we got to do drugs. We got to fight these communists.
Absolutely. And you know, they're looking at it like, hey, Washington is not giving us what we need to do this right. So we got to figure it out.
We got to be good soldiers and be resourceful.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's what they're doing. Now, you know, what that ends up turning into, who knows? But that's sort of what's presented here, is that they're selling drugs. Or, well, they're not selling. They're shipping drugs. And they're taking, you know, the profits from that to privately fund their own little war, and really, I mean, if you go back and, you know, read about Vietnam and the CIA and the training at 64, 60, you know, at 64, 65, it was right before sort of more of the actual, you know, ground war in Vietnam. This was at this time a lot of it was training the South Vietnamese to fight their own war. They were just really shitty at it. They didn't, you know, and they didn't have the equipment. They didn't have the training, and they were just getting their asses handed to them by the North Vietnamese at that time. But at this point, really, the, you know, American soldiers were not there to be fighting a war. They were not, you know, yet doing that, really, in 64, 65, from all accounts. But soon afterwards, and we see in this next sequence, in the final sequence of this issue, as they're all sort of sitting around talking about what's going on, there's one of the colonels on the phone, and he relays the message to all the guys that there had been a warship fired upon in international war waters by torpedo boats. The North Vietnamese had attacked the warships, and this is in real world. You know, this was something that led
the catalyst.
This was the catalyst. It was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, as it came to be known, because they were in the Gulf of Tonkin. At this point, Johnson uses this to all of a sudden escalate the war in Vietnam and convince the American people and the media that we need to send more troops. They're firing on our ships unwarranted. It later came out that that was kind of bullshit, that there was a couple of different accounts of ships being fired upon. The first one was the Maddox, the USS Maddox incident, and it had been fired upon, but it seems only after they had fired first, and no, that didn't come out until later. And then there was another incident that was reported and used as leverage to by Johnson that ended up being completely false and made up.
So Azzarello is still keeping with history.
Yes, very much so.
Again, expertly written. I mean, he done a shit ton of research and figured out a way to make his story fit in with actual events and you know, rationale for doing things. And
yeah, well, he's definitely using Eddie as sort of, I think, an analog for
the nation's decisions.
Yeah, I think so, to some degree. I
almost
mean,
like a bit of a sad Uncle Sam.
Little bit, yeah. You know, like he's putting him in these places.
Cynical.
And saying this is why maybe certain decisions were made, or this is how certain people felt. This is how the country, you know, because still to this point there wasn't really, I don't think, you know, and forgive me, you know, this is all very much, you know, history based, and I'm not the best history student. I enjoy history, but
no,
I'm not an expert in history, and the information I'm relaying here is to my best of my knowledge, and I could be completely wrong on some things, but at that point in time, I don't believe, you know, the American public still was behind Johnson and the presidency at that point about Vietnam. It wasn't until later that really the protests started coming out and more of that, you know, happened. But at this point, you know, America was still, for the most part, behind us being in Vietnam. For the majority. So I think, you know, you kind of see that in Eddie of like, hey, we got to fight communism. It's our duty to do this. If we don't stop the red, you know, menace now, it'll come to our shores. And I think that's what the American people felt. And in some ways, Eddie's sort of naive about it, you know, or you know, blindly patriotic about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I could blindly patriotic.
And so I think we're kind of going to see that change at some point, along with how our, as a nation, how we changed on the, you know, the feelings of Vietnam War. So I think that's going to be interesting in the future. But this last sequence is basically Johnson's speech about the shoot, the incident, the USS Maddox incident, and how he then started, you know, to use this to his advantage to convince the American people we needed to send more troops. And I think, like, you know, at that point, I want to say 1964, there was like 17,000 American troops, and it soon went up to, you know, or no, there's probably more than that, because Kennedy escalated it at one point. But then I think Johnson,
he hit the panic button full on.
Yeah, and really,
I wonder if Azzarello is going to cap each issue with a historic speech, because he did it the last issue, of course, with Kennedy's. Well, it was the broadcast of the news broadcast as Kennedy
right.
shot.
Yeah, it was the Cronkite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely using, you know, these historic tent poles at each, at the end of each episode or issue so far. But
well, what did you think? And we'll talk about Pirates of the Caribbean after after you tell me what you think about the overall issue and everything.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, so far I've absolutely loved both of these issues. I think, I mean, like I said, I'm sort of a history buff. Vietnam is, you know, is an era of history that I, you know, keep wanting to learn more about. And, the, you know, the Kennedy stuff, I've always been a Kennedy, you know, fan and interested in that stuff. And this is just sort of like, you know, really in my wheelhouse of, okay, let's take a deeper look at stuff that happened around this
time. I could
time
see and, you, and I said this before we started recording, I could... I was reading this, and I could feel you researching as you were. Oh, really? Let me look into what.
Oh, absolutely! Happened. Yeah, and, absolutely.
Yeah,
I did. And you know, it's funny. There's a. Oh, what did I do with it? I saved it because I wanted to bring it up. There's an interesting character I came across. There was two actually, but the one guy that I thought was pretty interesting. This is a real life guy named Anthony Poshepny. He was a CIA operative in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam and stuff. And he went in and helped train Southern Vietnamese soldiers and all sorts of crazy stories. Like he trained them to like take the ears of their victims for a body count. And he would like send those ears back to like CIA headquarters with his mission reports and stuff like that. And he would like put heads on
Holy
spikes
shit.
And yeah, this dude is, he, I mean, he was hardcore, and there was rumor that he was the inspiration.
Yeah. For Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. But that was both him, both, Tony Poe, as he's, is known, Anthony Poshepny. He was known as Tony Poe, both he and who did Apocalypse Now? God, I can't think of the director.
The guy that did Godfather, what's his name?
Puzo? No, he wrote it.
Oh my God.
Jesus, we're a couple of idiots. Coppola.
Coppola
both said it wasn't him, but if you get a minute, if you want to read some interesting stuff, there's some interesting stories about Tony Poe in Vietnam and his efforts in that area for the CIA. And I think, I wouldn't be surprised if Azzarello knows who Tony Poe is, and that maybe Eddie's sort of following a little bit of Tony's adventures to some degree. But I was definitely intrigued by a lot of this kind of stuff and going back and trying to research it and remember and look a little bit into, you know, because the thing for me is like, okay, you know, you can say Vietnam. Oh, this was during the Vietnam War. But the Vietnam War lasted from, like, 1950 to 1972.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and even before that, you know, with the French occupation.
And honestly, if you say Vietnam War, I'm going, oh, God, what? I mean, I get confused over a lot of the aspects of it.
So this is what, I mean, that's what I really did was, like, okay, I wanted to really think about, like, the timeline and what was going on during this period, and it... Azarilla did his homework. I mean,
totally.
This really makes sense. Yeah. Everything that happens in here is very much in line with what's going on and you know at that time, and it's just so
intriguing.
Well done. Yeah. Intriguing. Oh, absolutely. So I loved it. I mean,
and the art.
Oh, the art I think was great. I actually felt like this was better than the first issue. To me, I think.
Well, go ahead. You're still giving your rundown.
No. That was it. I thought the art was good. I think Jones does a nice job of blending, you know, real world stuff and events, but still it has a
comic language.
It has a comic language, and it even has to me an alternate reality look to it. It's not super realistic in style. It still looks
enough
fake, a little, you know, not fake, but just, you know, it's not our world.
Animated.
It's not our world. It's close, but not quite our world. But I think Jones did a good job.
Well, I like the story, and the issue itself was not, I didn't feel like it was it was really sensational. I mean, you had to really appreciate the intricacies. It really enriched it if you did, you know, some topical research as you was reading it. I think it's more thought provoking than it is just, you know, sheer comic book. Oh, this is a good issue. Enjoying it definitely leads to serves as connective tissue to a greater narrative, I think.
I could definitely see that where, like, it's not a super exciting issue.
But I mean, I enjoyed it as much as any, you know, one and done comic where you had some sort of a beginning, middle, and end or whatever.
To me, it was sort of like this really interesting documentary about a guy that we didn't know about in Vietnam and throughout history. You know, Eddie Blake is sort of like an evil Forrest Gump at this point. Like, he's,
I thought that well, I mean, yeah, I see what you're saying as far as him traipsing through history, but I kind of like the cynical, evil Uncle Sam analogy.
Right. Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, yeah, I mean, I think he definitely is an analog for the American male. The American male at that time, the general sense of, you know, American ideology, which at that time was still very much male dominated.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's capturing that with Eddie. So far,
I like the art too. I thought the art was better than the first one. I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe it was something that was just that grabbed me on the first issue. The whole panel layout. I don't know what it was. I would say this art style is, would you say it's kind of house style for DC? Maybe a little bit. Because I don't know what DC Comics' house style is, but
yeah, I mean, it's not, you know, it's certainly Jones. You know, Jones is a good artist. I don't know. He's not. I don't think he's one of those guys that is gonna just blow you away with stuff. And
he's
the
right artist for this. I mean, because you know who everybody is.
Yeah,
he's taking you to historical locations and actual events, and you know, I mean, we're dealing with specific firearms and uniforms in the Vietnam conflict. So he's the right artist for the job. I thought it he's served the story well in that regard.
Yeah, I think this book,
they were just serviceable.
Say that again.
The colors, I thought the colors were just, you know.
Yeah, right. Nothing. I mean, I think this book is going to stand on the writing more so than the art.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily going to be something where you're going to be talking about, oh, did you see that panel? Did you see that image? The art is there to serve the story in this one, I think, more than the other way around sometimes. You know, and sometimes you go the other way where it's like, okay, the story's okay, but the art is just fantastic. Where this one is, I think it's the story's really what's getting you, and the art is serviceable. I don't even want to say that. I think it's better than serviceable. I think it's pretty good. It's not going to, you know, just kill it, you know.
Is that you on page 3?
What?
Ryan Salazar.
I don't remember.
See if you can find yourself on page 3.
On page 3, there's an old guy with glasses. There's the guy between the two glasses? Or the guy between the two guys. Am I looking at the right page? Where there is
this
it
is
with
the page
Frank
where
with Frank
Cassius
and
Clay is yelling in red.
Yay?
Yeah, the panel right above. You got your arm up. That kind of that's kind of a Brian Salazar.
Wait, which guy?
He's sitting beside Bobby Kennedy.
I don't see.
I figure you know Azzarello. Maybe you kind of got a word in. Hey, why don't you put me in?
No, I don't know Az that well. I mean, I've sat with him and talked with him, but I don't think I know him well enough to put.
Well, maybe it's not. You know, I see you a lot in comics. You know,
I have one of those. I have a very, you know, comic book.
A lot of artists put you in their books.
I've only been in one comic that I'm aware of. Well, no, that's not true. I've been in two that I'm aware of. I've been in Daredevil, and I was in Loaded Bible.
Loaded
2,
Bible,
I believe. Yeah. Daredevil. It didn't really look like me. It was my name, but it was for me. I mean, it was specifically put in there.
There should be more of that, honestly.
Well, there may be. We just don't know it. You know, we just don't. You know, not aware of it.
Well, what'd you think about the Pirates of Penzance this week, Sal?
A little more interesting, I think. Basically, you know, our protagonist is on this ship with the Crimson Corsair. He's on the
Crimson Croquettes.
Croquette, the Crimson Croquette. And he's saying, hey, I gotta get out of here. I gotta get back to my people. This is, you know, I can't be on this, I can't be on this cursed pirate ship. I got things to do, buddy.
Yeah, man.
And the Crimson Corsair is nice enough to go, well, you know, there is a way, it's never actually been tried. Nobody's had the balls to do it, but there is a way to get off the ship. You have to accomplish 3 goals. And the first, you must bring me the golden earring of an unborn child. The second is the tattoo from a dead man's chest. And the third, what?
I'm just kind of going, you're reading off the stuff he has to get, and I'm kind of, I mean, given the reaction that he gave, which is, there's a little bit of humor right here. Did you not pick up on this kind of levity, this humor, that it kind of switched gears into this humor gear? When he's saying these crazy things he's got to get, and your man is here going, what sort of madness? And then he says, but how? And then the Crimson Corsair just quickly says, hey, that's your problem, not mine. And the third thing you got to get.
Right. Yeah, it was a little like the Crimson Corsair all of a sudden turned in from like this spooky, you know, supernatural kind of character to more of like this.
George Carlin. Given a rundown on these crazy things.
The third one, he said, will be revealed when the moment is right, assuming he can collect the first two.
He's probably given that speech to every single one of those poor souls on that ship.
Yeah, probably. I mean, you know, you don't get a pirate ship full of cursed souls without having, you know, to go through a few. But
that's some crazy things. You can't get the golden earring of an unborn child.
Well, I'm assuming it's some sort of like riddle-ish kind of thing. You know,
sure.
I don't think it's just straight, you know, forward golden earring of an unborn child. you know, I don't know, what does that mean? A golden earring of an unborn? I haven't really given any thought.
You're damned to this ship for eternity to work, right? To be a sailor, to work on the ship.
Right.
Well, I'm pretty sure that one of the duties sailors has to do is swab the deck. Man, look, the ship is, I mean, apparently everybody's just kind of laying around because the ship is horrible.
Well, I don't know that it's that kind of ship, man. I mean, I don't think that a ship full of cursed souls is all that concerned about the cleanliness of the deck. And I think really swabbing the deck was sort of overused in movies. I don't know that sailors spent a whole lot of time, you know,
well, they had to keep
mopping up.
They had to keep shit clean. I mean, honestly.
Well, yeah, but you're in the water and it's constantly rolling in the frickin' ship. I don't think it's all that dirty. You know, I don't think there's a whole lot of dust laying around on a frickin' pirate ship.
Hey, look, man, I've been on a
pirate ship?
Sailboat before.
A sailboat.
And I had to clean the deck.
Did you swab the deck?
That's only because I threw up some beer on it. But
oh, well, that doesn't even count. All right. Well, I think we have just gone into this way too long already. We've given this a lot more.
A lot of attention.
Overall, very, very good. I you know, this is the kind of thing that gets me, and this is what always got me about Alan Moore's writing, was it does make me want to research the stuff that he's writing about. Like, I want to know more about it, the events and the characters and the people and the times, because he, you know, Moore does this better than anybody, I think, where he takes, you know, characters and times and places in history, and he tells new interesting stories in the crevices and cracks in those places. And I think it's always what I've been fascinated with Alan Moore's writing, and I think Azzarello is doing a fantastic job of this.
Absolutely.
So, totally hooked by this so far and really enjoying it. I did want to mention a couple of things before we run off here. Next weekend, Wizard World Chicago, or the Chicago Comic Con, as it's called now, at Rosemont, at the Rosemont Convention Center in Rosemont, Illinois, I will have a table in Artist Alley. I'll be at table 3221, so you can come by and see me. It is August 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, I believe, are the dates. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in August, the 2nd, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in August. So I'll be there. Feel free to come by, say hello. You don't have to buy something. You can just say hi, and if you listen to the show, I would love to hear from you. So please come and visit me, because otherwise I'm just going to have to talk to the scum and villainy in Artist Alley, guys like Ryan Stegman and, you know, creepy. Just
as it, would Ryan be – how does that work? Would he be like in Marvel's – section or something?
Well, it depends. A lot of times most of those guys will have a table of their own, and then they will do signings at the Marvel booth. Now, Wizard World,
and Marvel's going to bring him out, right? Like, they're,
well,
going
not to that
release
one.
Ryan and walk him out with some staff.
No. Marvel won't even be at Wizard World. They don't do that show anymore. Marvel nor DC does that show. I don't believe
that's the big diss. I would take it for a comic book.
Yeah. So I don't know. I'm not sure why, but a lot of the creators still go, and it looks like it's, you know, that show's changing a bit. It's a different kind of show now than it once was. It's a lot more media guests and autograph sessions and that kind of stuff. But it still has a really nice Artist Alley, and there's going to be a lot of cool folks there. So. If you are coming, please come and visit me. Then I also wanted to promote, in September, I am going to be at the Cincinnati Comic Con.
I may be there.
And yes, you may be there. We may be together, live recording episodes. So.
Live recording. You actually, I don't go to a lot of conventions. I've been to a few. So it's kind of a big shit deal that I'll, you know, if you go to the Cincinnati Comic Con, you know. I'll be there.
It may be the only chance you ever get to meet Braxton.
Yeah, just shaking hands.
Possibly.
And, you know, we'll talk, chat, and what have you. It'll be a huge, huge deal.
Huge deal. For more information on any of that stuff, you can go to briansalazar.com, BrionSalazar.com. I have information on there under the appearances button on the right-hand side. It'll tell you information about both.
You got
an
appearances button on BrianSalazar.com.
Well, I appear at places, so yeah, I figured I'd categorize my appearances so people can easily find the information. It's not an ego thing. It's just
sounds like a chupacabra sightings or something.
It's just that my appearances. You never know where I'll show up. I am like Bigfoot, kind of. Or you can go to wizardworld.com for the Chicago Comic Con for information about that show, or CincinnatiComicExpo.com for that show. And there's going to be awesome people at that one too, like George Perez and Tony Moore and Wiles Portacio, and I kind of forgot who else is coming, but there's lots of other Rick Veitch, Thomas Eads, a whole bunch of, if you're a Swamp Thing fan, John Tuttleman, Stephen Bissett, Rick Veitch, Thomas Sheets, a bunch of Swamp.
I think I was listening to Crankcast. I think Norton had mentioned maybe showing up. And I think of course, that's his hometown. He should probably be
there. Crank will probably be there. Yeah, so it, you know, I haven't been to that show yet, but it's going to be awesome because I'm going to be there. So, well, I don't know. It'll probably be awesome.
Because it'll be awesome.
There'll be other people there too.
I love the Queen City, man. Cincinnati, the Queen City. WKRP in Cincinnati, man. Johnny Fever.
Oh yeah, it does look like Norton is on the list. I didn't know he was on the officially on the Cincinnati Comic Con. I can't get away from that guy.
Yeah.
You know, ever since I won him an Eisner for Battle Pug, you know,
you?
Yeah, I had a hand in it. I had a little piece of it. I should get a little tiny. That's two Eisner award-winning comics that I've had. A tiny, 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 tiny.
What was the other one, Scotty?
Yeah, Oz. I did the logo for Oz.
And golly, you got the magic touch.
I know. People should hire me in some way to work on their comic because I'm like absolutely you're gonna win an Eisner if I work on your comic in some way. Just saying, people. I'm just saying. What else do I have to say? In researching the Vietnam War, specifically for this episode, I did run across a guy that I just wanted to bring up his name. And if you're interested in reading about stories of Vietnam, this is a guy that I don't know how many people have ever heard of him. There has been some info. There's a book about him, and I think there was a movie about him or a documentary about him. But his name is Hugh Thompson Jr., and he was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. And I just happened, I don't even know how I got to his page, like Wikipedia, you know how it is. You just like, you start looking at stuff and you end up somewhere you don't even know. Yeah. But I ended up reading about this guy, and there was an incident in Vietnam called the My Lai Massacre. And it's it was March 16th, 1968, and there was this battalion had went into this village or group of villages and basically were slaughtering all the people, men, women, and children. And there was really no proof that they were Viet Cong. They seemed to be unarmed civilians, but American soldiers were killing them all. And this helicopter pilot happened to see it. A couple different series of events. He went down and tried to stop them or tried to get them to help him get some people out of a ditch. Then he landed again and actually rescued a few people a couple of times. And then he reported the whole thing. And he basically did the right thing, which was very, you know, was not done enough in Vietnam. There were some pretty horrific things.
You think that was one of the tales that, you know, spurred a lot of the baby killer name?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think absolutely that this was one. I mean, the My Lai, I don't know how you say it. It's M-Y-L-A-I, My Lai Massacre.
Melee,
maybe. It was definitely one of the, you know, sort of catalysts for a lot of that. And I think, you know, especially, you know, after this happened and he reported it and there was an investigation, they awarded him a medal, but it was even he ended up throwing the medal away because in it they kind of tried to cover it all up, saying that he had rescued people from crossfire. And it wasn't crossfire. There's nobody shooting back. He had rescued people from murder. And so it wasn't until years and years later that he was officially recognized, and you know, in his later life, he ended up, you know, like speaking about the ethics of war and all sorts of things. But really interesting story. I think it's one that people should know about, and people, you know, I just, as I read it, I was like, wow, this is really a great story. I'm glad that I found out about this guy, and I want other people to read about him, because there's a lot of terrible things that would happen in Vietnam. I certainly am not a, you know, I'm not trying to judge anyone or anything like that. But this guy, I think, you know, you didn't necessarily, I think it's one of the hardest things to do, especially for military people, is to question other soldiers, to question their superiors. You know, you see it in, whether it's the military, whether it's in schools, whether it's in police, you know, any of those kind of places where people can abuse their power. And you have people that, you know, don't stand up to it, don't question it, and don't, you know, maybe do the right thing that they think that we want them to do, out of fear of retaliation, out of fear of,
you know, duty.
Yeah, you know, whatever it is. And this guy did, and he stuck by it, and he put up with a lot of crap, and he, you know, he got death threats, he got all sorts of things in his life for really just doing the right thing. And thankfully, later in his life, you know, as we as a nation looked back and realized, you know, what was going on in Vietnam and how wrong a lot of the things there were, and he was eventually, you know...
Yeah, history has properly, a way of doing that.
Properly, you know, commendated for it, and I, you know, but I still think, you know, if you get a chance, go look him up. Like I said, his name is Hugh Thompson Jr. He was a United States Army helicopter.
Did he have a book out? Did you read his book?
I did not read his book.
Research on him.
I just, like I said, I just happened to fall across his name in something else that I was reading about, and then I was intrigued by him, and so I started reading about him. There is a book out called...
See you, man. Since this book's come out and all the research you've been doing on this issue, you've probably been like Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now inside the hotel with no shirt on, just a cigarette.
I definitely could. I mean, I could definitely fall down a rabbit hole when it comes to this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I should be some sort of research assistant or something, you know, like... Just put me on the trail of something, and I'll, you know, I'll obsess over it until I find out everything there is to know. But the problem is I can't remember anything. Like, my memory is so crappy that I'll forget it tomorrow. But there is a book out, I believe. It's called 4 Hours in My Lay. And I think there's also a film or a documentary.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
On it. But yeah, if you get a chance, like I said, it's a story of a guy doing the right thing, and the massacre is horrific. I'll, you know, warn you, it's pretty terrible stuff. And there's photo, you know, if you go on Wikipedia or whatever, there's photographs of it, and there's, you know, there's pretty graphic things. But his story should be something that we as Americans should remember. And, you know, I think it's a good story about a guy doing what he should have, or, you know, doing the right thing.
There you go.
And there you go. Sorry, I didn't mean to
bring the party down.
Yeah, sorry about that. What else? You can visit us at www.aroundcomics.com. You can email us at info@aroundcomics.com. You can tweet us at aroundcomics.com or at briansalazar.com or at Braxton9, the number 9. You can go to our website, and we have a forum, and you can go on there and tell us how stupid we are, and we don't know anything about Vietnam or history.
Don't do that.
Or, well, I don't care.
Honestly, don't do that.
All right, don't call us stupid, but if you have something to say to us, nice or critical, whatever it may be,
yeah, feel go free. In there, mix it up, yeah. Especially with this issue. I mean,
Yeah, there's a ton of in this one. Yeah, and like I said,
I
am not an expert of anything. Certainly not history. I tried to do my best in the time I had to research this and get as much information correct about it. I really wanted to know the time frames and you know, logistically how things were in Vietnam at that time and what was going on in the country and that kind of stuff. So I did my best. Hopefully I didn't screw up anything too much, but you know, hey, it is what it is. You get what you pay for. and this episode's free. So there you go. I think that's it, man. I think,
another one down. Next, what's the next one, Sal?
I don't even know. I forgot to look.
Yeah, we should know that. We should have that a pocket answer.
You're right. I should know that.
You know what I haven't been doing is looking at the alternate covers for some of these issues. Are they still doing that, or was that just the issue
one? This one actually was a very good one by – God. Okay.
Variant cover.
There was only one, I think, variant cover. No, there was two. One by J.J. Jones and then one by –
Tim Bradstreet.
Bradstreet, so thank you. God, I couldn't.
Oh, man, yeah, I'm looking at it.
Bradstreet's is very cool. It reminds me of something, and I can't think of what.
Is it yellow and white? He's got a pin on. He's got a Dr. Manhattan symbol pin. How freaking weird is my head exploding? What does that meta stuff mean?
I don't know.
Instead of the smiley face, he's got a Dr. Manhattan symbol on his
uniform. He does? Uniform.
Yeah, man.
No.
I love it. Yeah.
You're crazy.
No, I'm looking right at it.
I don't know. I don't know, man. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out what it means. What it could mean. What could it possibly...
Yeah, that's a good cover right there.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. Can you look and see what's next? Is it still back? No.
Yeah, hang on a second. Let's see what the next one is. Oh, the slut.
Wow, really? You had to go there with it? It's Spectre, Silk Spectre again?
Surely not.
No, we just did number two of Silk Spectre. I don't believe you.
No, I was saying the slut from the Minutemen issue. You know how they had the frog and the... those crazy characters.
Oh, yeah,
there's a lot. You know what? I can't find a place to find out who.
Maybe that's why.
Next one's going
to
be.
Go online and find it out. I don't know.
Maybe it's going to be Ozymandias.
We'll tell you next week when we do the episode. Then you'll know. That's it. All right. This has gone on long enough. Too long, in fact. And yeah, thank you for listening once again. Braxton, thank you for joining me. Thanks, as always.
Always.
And adios. Adios. MFers.
Mother effers.
Mother humper. I don't know. I'm too tired. I started coaching football this week. I'm exhausted.
Good night.
Good night.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam. And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled the battle outside. outside raging. We'll soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing. Our mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. It is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.